Please be seated. I give you a new commandment, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. This defines the Christian life. It has motivated Christians to feed the hungry, nurture the lonely, and care for the sick. And loving one another has come to mean good works are synonymous with following this new commandment. If only it were that simple. Let's be honest. Loving one another as Christ has loved us is next to impossible. Christian history is filled with the stories of saints and martyrs who generations have thought they epitomized what it is to live this new commandment. However, one thing that I've certainly noticed is that without accepting heartfelt forgiveness of ourselves and thus all others, it is impossible. This love requires us to have a deep, visceral experience of forgiveness. You see, it's easier to love those who are needy in ways we are not. And I'm sure you've all heard that familiar phrase, "There but for the grace of God go I." In that statement, there is no love but judgment. No love but pity born out of guilt. Acts of service done with perceived humility can create temporary relief, but guilt and its cousin judgment soon reassert themselves. So if we begin with the fact that we have been forgiven, what else does the resurrection shower us with but inclusive love? However, what I've noticed in myself and others is the question of worthiness creeps in. If we feel unworthy, read conditionally loved, how then can we be capable of love? If we serve the vulnerable yet continue to see them as the broken, the unforgiven, then they are diminished in our eyes, as are we. This is not love. It's interesting to look more closely at the reading from John's Gospel and where this particular reading is placed. A few verses before, Jesus mentions Judas' betrayal. And after the reading, Jesus predicts Peter's denial. It's a curious juxtaposition. I wonder what Jesus was thinking when he spoke these words on love. Yet, we know he washed the feet of Judas and Peter, and we know that he fed them both. And in this commandment, he tells us to do the same. But John's Gospel adds another twist to the story. It could appear as though Judas came back after the resurrection to be counted as one of the 12. Only John's Gospel refers to the disciples as the 12 rather than the 11. In Luke, Acts, women return to the 11 to report the resurrection, and the disciples later elect Matthias to replace Judas. In Matthew, Judas hangs himself, and towards the end, the 11 go to Galilee. In Mark, Jesus appeared to the 11, but in John, Jesus appears to all the disciples except Thomas, who was one of the 12. It's a remarkably arresting phrase to read after the resurrection in the light of the other Gospels, and to realize that in John, no one is missing. Judas hasn't fallen headlong in a field, hung himself, or just disappeared from the story. In John, they are whole. They are still the 12 disciples. Makes you think, doesn't it? It could be a complete rewriting of the gospel record and of Judas' story. It could be seen as an alternative ending, where Jesus really does keep his promise that he would not lose even one of them. And in it, there's no fanfare of forgiveness or reconciliation, no summit on how it really happened. But Judas was lost, and then he was found. He's just there, in the background, desperately happy to be there, relieved he's not bleeding out in a field or swinging from a rope or completely erased from the resurrection. The odds for reconciliation and forgiveness are stacked against him. 3/4 of the time he winds up dead or lost. But this one miraculous time, there is quiet, unassuming forgiveness done behind closed doors. This one miraculous time, Judas lives. It forces me to wonder why, for over 2,000 years of Christian history, we still haven't forgiven him or even see him as a candidate for Christ's love. Thus, it's important to wonder about this statement in John's gospel. Judas, this evil or tragic figure of Christian history, could be transformed by his fellow disciples' love into the first person whose sins the disciples chose not to retain, but to forgive. Moving back into our time and life as Christians, I have a question for you. How many of you have heard of Will Campbell? I don't see nods, so let me introduce you to him. He was a contemporary and friend of Martin Luther King Jr. Campbell was a courageous man who was one of 4 people who escorted the 9 black students to integrate into Little Rock Central High School. He was also the only white person invited to attend the founding of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, again by Martin Luther King Jr. After 20 years in ministry, he began to wonder what it is to love as Christ has loved. Over time, he realized that in helping the most vulnerable, he had nurtured a hate for those red-necked bigots who hated blacks. He wrote, "It really is strange how much I enjoyed thinking God hated all the same people that I hated." Campbell eventually came to realize that after all those years in ministry, he had become little more than a doctrinaire social activist. It was a startling realization. He began doing things differently. He became known as the bootleg preacher, someone comfortable at a moonshine still or in a pulpit. He became the personal pastor to people we might label as terrorists. The key? He writes, "I came to understand the nature of tragedy. And one who understands the nature of tragedy can never take sides." Campbell realized he had unintentionally subverted the indiscriminate love of God for all people without conditions, limits, or exceptions into a ministry of liberal sophistication. The change for him came through forgiveness of self and others. Counterintuitive. No righteous indignation to energize one, no us and them. Love others without exception. So he started sipping whiskey with the Ku Klux Klan. He became known as the civil rights chaplain to the Klan. He was loved and accepted by many of them. He performed their funerals and weddings, befriended the Grand Dragon of North Carolina, and when they were sick, he emptied their bedpans and comforted them. Campbell's words and example are challenging. In our context, I remember back to the group called Mad as Hell, their title, not my language. Their convictions and strident communications were very upsetting, and for me, were the epitome of all that is wrong in the world. They seemed ready to go to any lengths, including violence, only to achieve their ends. Or what about the owner of a car I saw this past week, bearing a sign proclaiming babies on board? The picture, instead of showing cute stylized babies, depicted various sizes of guns and automatic weapons. Or what about the retail store owners who post signs which graphically state that no one is allowed to loiter, sleep, or be near their shops? Or what about those who believe homeless people are lazy and would be just fine if they pulled up their socks and got a job? Campbell's insights remind us that we too must prayerfully reflect on the tragedy or the trauma of others and act loving from a place inside ourselves where there are no sides taken, and love is the only possible response. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Amen.